6. The Inner Sphere. There was no room for fear, no time for alarm in the dazed and chaotic turmoil of my sensations. I was stupefied by all that I had experienced, and moreover, the drug-like spell of the flame was upon me, even though I could not hear its fatal singing. I believe that I struggled a little, by some sort of mechanical muscular revulsion, against the tentacular arms that were wound about me, but the lepidopters gave no heed. It was plain that they were conscious of nothing but the mounting fire and its seductive music. I remember, however, that there was no sensation of actual heat, such as might have been expected when we neared the soaring column. Instead, I felt the most ineffable thrilling in all my fibers, as if I were being permeated by waves of celestial energy and demiurgic ecstasy. Then we entered the flame. Like Angarth before me, I had taken it for granted that the fate of all those who flung themselves into the flame was an instant, though blissful, destruction. I expected to undergo a briefly flaring dissolution, followed by the nothingness of utter annihilation. The thing which really happened was beyond the boldest reach of speculative thought, and to give even a meager idea of my sensations would beggar the resources of language. The flame enfolded us like a green curtain, blotting from view the great chamber. Then it seemed to me that I was caught and carried to super-celestial heights, in an upward-rushing cataract of quintessential force and deific rapture, and an all-illuminating light. It seemed that I, and my companions, had achieved a godlike union with the flame, that every atom of our bodies had undergone a transcendental expansion, and was winged with ethereal lightness. It was as if we no longer existed except as one divine, indivisible unity, soaring beyond the trammels of matter, beyond the limits of space and time, to attain undreamable shores. Unspeakable was the joy, and infinite the freedom of that ascent in which we seemed to overpass the zenith of the highest star. Then, as if we had risen with the flame to its culmination, had reached its very apex, we emerged and came to a pause. My senses were faint with exultation, my eyes blind with the glory of the fire, and the world on which I now gazed was a vast arabesque of unfamiliar forms and bewildering hues from another spectrum than the one to which our eyes are habituated. It swirled before my dizzy eyes like a labyrinth of gigantic jewels, with interweaving ways and tangled lustres, and only by slow degrees was I able to establish order and distinguish detail in the surging riot of my perceptions. All about me were endless avenues of superprismatic opal and jacinthine, arches and pillars of ultraviolet gems, of transcendent sapphire, of unearthly ruby and amethyst, all suffused with a multi-tinted splendor. I appeared to be treading on jewels, and above me was a jeweled sky. Presently, with recovered equilibrium, with eyes adjusted to a new range of cognition, I began to perceive the actual features of the landscape. With the two moth-like beings still beside me, I was standing on a million-flowered grass, among trees of a paradisal vegetation, with fruit, foliage, blossoms, and trunks whose very forms were beyond the conception of tri-dimensional life. The grace of their drooping boughs, of their fretted fronds, was inexpressible in terms of earthly line and contour, and they seemed to be wrought of pure ethereal substance, half translucent to the empyrean light, which accounted for the gem-like impression I had first received. I breathed the nectar-laden air, and the ground beneath me was ineffably soft and resilient, as if it were composed of some higher form of matter than ours. My physical sensations were those of the utmost buoyancy and well-being, with no trace of fatigue or nervousness, such as might have been looked for after the unparalleled and marvelous events in which I had played a part. I felt no sense of mental dislocation or confusion, and, apart from my ability to recognize unknown colors and non-Euclidean forms, I began to experience a queer alteration and extension of tactility, through which it seemed that I was able to touch remote objects. The radiant sky was filled with many-colored suns, like those that might shine on a world of some multiple solar system. But, as I gazed, their glory became softer and dimmer, and the brilliant luster of the trees and grass was gradually subdued, as if by encroaching twilight. I was beyond surprise, in the boundless marvel and mystery of it all, and nothing, perhaps, would have seemed incredible. But if anything could have amazed me, or defied belief, it was the human face. The face of my vanished friend, Giles Angarth, which now emerged from among the waning jewels of the forest, followed by that of another man whom I recognized from photographs as Felix Ebonley. They came out from beneath the gorgeous boughs and paused before me. Both were clad in lustrous fabrics, finer than oriental silk, and of no earthly cut or pattern. Their look was both joyous and meditative, and their faces had taken on a hint of the same translucency that characterized the ethereal fruits and blossoms. "We have been looking for you," said Angarth. "It occurred to me that, after reading my journal, you might be tempted to try the same experiment, if only to make sure whether the account was truth or fiction. This is Felix Ebonley, whom I believe you have never met." It surprised me when I found that I could hear his voice with perfect ease and clearness, and I wondered why the effect of the drug-soaked cotton should have died out so soon in my auditory nerves. Yet such details were trivial in the face of the astounding fact that I had found Angarth and Ebonley, that they, as well as I, had survived the unearthly rapture of the flame. "Where are we?" I asked, after acknowledging his introduction. "I confess that I am totally at a loss to comprehend what has happened." "We are now in what is called the inner dimension," explained Angarth. "It is a higher sphere of space and energy and matter than the one into which we were precipitated from Crater Ridge, and the only entrance is through the Singing Flame in the city of Yemos. The inner dimension is born of the fiery fountain, and sustained by it, and those who fling themselves into the flame are lifted thereby to this superior plane of vibration. For them, the outer worlds no longer exist. The nature of the flame itself is not known, except that it is a fountain of pure energy springing from the central rock beneath Yemos, and passing beyond mortal ken, by virtue of its own ardency." He paused, and seemed to be peering attentively at the winged entities, who still lingered at my side. Then he continued, "I haven't been here long enough to learn very much myself, but I have found out a few things, and Ebonley and I have established a sort of telepathic communication with the other beings who have passed through the flame. Many of them have no spoken language, no organs of speech, and their very methods of thought are basically different from ours, because of their divergent lines of sense development and the varying conditions of the worlds from which they come, but we are able to communicate a few images. The persons who came with you are trying to tell me something," he went on. "You and they, it seems, are the last pilgrims who will enter Yemos and attain the inner dimension. War is being made on the flame and its guardians by the rulers of the outer lands, because so many of their people have obeyed the lure of the singing fountain and vanished into the higher sphere. Even now their armies have closed in upon Yemos and are blasting the city's ramparts with the force bolts of their moving towers." I told him what I had seen, comprehending now much that had been obscure heretofore. He listened gravely and then said, "It has long been feared that such war would be made sooner or later. There are many legends in the outer lands concerning the flame, and the fate of those who succumb to its attraction, but the truth is not known, and is guessed only by a few. Many believe, as I did, that the end is destruction, and by some who suspect its existence, the inner dimension is hated as a thing that lures idle dreamers away from worldly reality. It is regarded as a lethal and pernicious chimera, as a mere poetic dream, or a sort of opium paradise. There are a thousand things to tell you regarding the inner sphere and the laws and conditions of being to which we are now subject, after the revibration of our own component atoms in the flame, but at present there is no time to speak further, since it is highly probable that we are all in grave danger, that the very existence of the inner dimension, as well as our own, is threatened by the immiscible forces that are destroying Yemos. There are some who say that the flame is impregnable, that its pure essence will defy the blasting of all inferior beams, and that its source remains impenetrable to the lightnings of the outer lords. But most are fearful of disaster, and expect the failure of the fountain itself when Yemos is riven to the central rock. Because of this imminent peril, we must not tarry longer. There is a way which affords egress from the inner sphere to another and remoter cosmos in a second infinity, a cosmos unconceived by mundane astronomers, or by the astronomers of the worlds about Yemos. The majority of the pilgrims, after a term of sojourn here, have gone on to the worlds of this other universe, and Eb Only and I have waited only for your coming before following them. We must make haste, and delay no more, or doom will overtake us. Even as he spoke, the two moth-like entities, seeming to resign me to the care of my human friends, arose on the jewel-tinted air, and sailed in long, level flight above the paradisal perspectives whose remoter avenues were lost in glory. Angarth and Eb Only had now stationed themselves beside me, and one took me by the left arm, and the other by the right. "Try to imagine that you are flying," said Angarth. "In this sphere, levitation and flight are possible through willpower, and you will soon acquire the ability. We shall support and guide you, however, till you have grown accustomed to the new conditions, and are independent of such help." I obeyed his injunction, and formed a mental image of myself in the act of flying. I was amazed by the clearness and vermicillitude of the thought picture, and still more by the fact that the picture was becoming an actuality. With little sense of effort, but with exactly the same feeling that characterizes a levitational dream, the three of us were soaring from the jeweled ground, slanting easily and swiftly upward through the glowing air. Any attempt to describe the experience would be foredoomed to futility, since it seemed that a whole range of new senses had been opened up in me, together with corresponding thought symbols for which there are no words in human speech. I was no longer Philopastane, but a larger, stronger, and freer entity, differing as much from my former self as the personality developed beneath the influence of hashish or kava would differ. The dominant feeling was one of immense joy and liberation, coupled with a sense of imperative haste, of the need to escape into other realms where the joy would endure eternal and unthreatened. My visual perceptions, as we flew above the burning lucent woods, was marked by intense aesthetic pleasure. It was as far above the normal delight afforded by agreeable imagery as the forms and colors of this world were beyond the cognition of normal eyes. Every changing image was a source of veritable ecstasy, and the ecstasy mounted as the whole landscape began to brighten again and returned to the flashing, scintillating glory it had worn when I first beheld it.